welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, August 16, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Good afternoon, and welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome today three experts. We're going to hear opening remarks from each in turn and then a round of rebuttals. But as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions. So please do be thinking of those questions for when we get to that portion of the program. Opening remarks of about 10 to 12 minutes. We'll hear first from Professor Christopher C. Lund. He's at Wayne State University Law School. He'll be followed by Professor Thomas C. Berg. He's the James B. Oberstar Professor of Law and Public Policy at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. And then finally, we'll hear from Professor Martin S. Lederman. He's an Adjunct Associate Professor of Law at the Georgetown University Law Center. With that, Professor Lund, the floor is yours.
Thanks. It's good to be here. A very knowledgeable group. Marty and Tom are the best scholars in the field. We're talking today about a case pending in the Supreme Court, Trinity Lutheran Church versus Pauley. The briefs are now in. I don't think oral argument's been set yet, but it's an October 2016 term case, so all this will happen pretty quickly. The facts of this case are pretty straightforward. The state of Missouri has a program giving grants to organizations, typically schools and daycare centers, for them to purchase recycled tires to resurface their playgrounds. So playgrounds can be dangerous. Recycled tire material is soft. You know, I have two kids, new playgrounds. They don't have wood chips anymore. They have this soft, spongy material that has some spring in it, and it reduces the risk of playground injuries. Anyway, Missouri has this program giving money to schools and daycare centers for them to resurface their playground. Now, not everyone gets funds. It's a competitive process. Applications are given points for various things, points for how well you document your application, points for using in-state suppliers of tire material, you know, points for shopping around, for getting quotes from a number of vendors, points if your playground is used by kids from low-income homes. You know, there's only limited funds. Missouri's trying to be a good steward of the money. In 2012, which is the relevant year, Missouri received 44 applications for funding, and it only funded 14 organizations. Now, Trinity Lutheran ranked fifth out of the 44 applications, but it didn't receive funding from Missouri. It didn't receive funding from Missouri because religious organizations are disqualified from receiving funds under the program. Like a number of states, Missouri has long had a state constitutional provision disqualifying religious groups from receiving state funds, and so Trinity Lutheran ended up not receiving funds. And the gravamen of their complaint is that they would have received funds if they had been a non-religious entity. From their perspective, they lost their funding because they were religious. In the Supreme Court, their claims are based in the Free Exercise Clause and the Equal Protection Clause. They say that the Constitution entitles them to these government funds on the same terms as non-religious groups. The Constitution forbids Missouri from categorically denying religious institutions this money. So let me turn now to the legal framework here. As I said, the case involves the Free Exercise Clause and Equal Protection Clause, but before that, we probably need to start with the Establishment Clause. Because over the past 70 years, the Supreme Court has had a long series of cases about government funds going to religious institutions, particularly religious schools, and these concerns go all the way back to the founding of the country and before. James Madison writes his memorial and remonstrance in protest of Patrick Henry's assessment bill that would have taxed people for the support of clergy. In the 19th century, there are disputes over government funds going to religious schools. Many states, including Missouri, adopt provisions restricting government funds from going to religious institutions. In 1947, the Supreme Court comes really into the picture. In the Everson case, the court says that the Establishment Clause, the First Amendment, puts limits on the government funding of religious schools, even as part of an even-handed program that funds religious schools on the same terms as other private schools. So the court in 1947 mostly agrees on the principle. The big disagreement is on how it applies. And the big question that divides the court is how much aid is too much. Everson actually upheld, by a 5-4 vote, governmental reimbursement of public bus fare to kids going to private schools. The court then finds itself contending with other issues: salary supplements for teachers, books and other instructional materials for students, construction grants for these schools. The court goes back and forth for a long, long time on this. Maybe with enough time and cases, a stable court could have reached a consensus. But new appointments to the court keep frustrating that. There's a long period of flux. In retrospect, though, we can dimly see a clear trend, which is that starting in about the late 1980s with a case called Witters, the court starts pretty consistently rejecting the Establishment Clause claims and allowing more and more aid to religious schools. It starts moving away from what you might call the no aid position toward what you might call an equal funding position. And eventually in 2002, the big turn happens. In a case called Zelman, the court approves the voucher program by the city of Cleveland. State funds going to religious schools in an undifferentiated way. There's some wrinkles which may or may not be important in Zelman. The check in Zelman actually goes to the parents who I think signed it over to the school. It doesn't go to the school directly. It follows the private choices of the parents to go to the religious school. Zelman is an indirect aid case in that sense. And the court's earlier cases, which it doesn't overrule in Zelman, that put more conditions when the funding is direct, when the money goes directly from the government to the religious institution. You know, some people wonder whether this should really be the case, but the court's always had more fears of direct aid than indirect aid. Maybe it looks more like government endorsement of religion or union between church and state. And with direct aid, because the aid isn't following private choices, there's fears of picking and choosing by the government among recipients. Anyway, the governing direct aid cases, Mitchell versus Helms in 2000, 2 years before Zelman. And in Mitchell, the court approves state money for instructional materials to go to religious schools, but there's a limiting concurrence by Justice O'Connor insisting on the condition that the instructional materials not be used for religious purposes. The government's aid, she says, can't be diverted to religious uses. That's an important word, diversion. So all this is to say that the court's transition to the equal funding position from the no aid position is slow and gradual, but real, but also incomplete. It hasn't fully gone in that direction. And while that transition is taking place, there's another transition that's happened. All of these cases, including Mitchell and Zelman, were about whether the government could fund religion, whether the Establishment Clause allows funding of religious organizations in a generally available aid program. But now there's a new question, right? Might the Constitution actually require funding of religious organizations in a generally available aid program? You know, traditionally, the court's cases were about whether the government could fund religion. These cases are about whether the government has to fund religion, and that's going to be Trinity Lutheran. Now, these cases originated in the area of public forums. Starting in 1981, in Widmar versus Vincent, the court says that religious organizations have rights to equal access to government property. There's a bunch of these public forum cases. They don't really involve money exactly. They're decided under the Free Speech Clause. But then in 1995, there's a public forum case, a free speech case, that involves money. And that's a case called Rosenberger, which involved a program at the University of Virginia, a public university, that reimbursed the funding of student publications. It denied reimbursement to an evangelical student publication because it was evangelical. And the court ruled 5-4 that this violated the free speech clause. So Rosenberger, in a sense, jumped the tracks. The court had long said that some aid to religious institutions was permitted, and now the court said that some aid is actually required by the Constitution. But Rosenberger was a free speech case involving public forum for speech. It wasn't clear whether it could or should be pushed beyond those boundaries. And that brings us to the single most important precedent in Trinity Lutheran, which is the Supreme Court's 2004 case in Locke versus Davey. Locke was the flip side of Zelman, the flip side of the voucher case in an important way. Zelman asked whether religious institutions could be included in a voucher program, and Locke asked whether, having created a voucher program, religious institutions had to be included, right? This is the move from can fund to must fund. Locke involved a college scholarship program. The state of Washington had a scholarship program for kids from low-income families to attend university. But the state of Washington specifically excluded kids who majored in devotional theology. You could use Washington scholarship to major in engineering, but you couldn't use it to major in theology. And the court, by a vote of 7-2, upheld this program. By 7-2 vote, the court said this didn't violate the Free Exercise Clause. The court said that the burden here is pretty mild, right? Students can still major in theology, they just can't get the government to pay for it. And the court said it's pretty long-standing that the government can refuse to fund clerical education. This is an area, the court says, that a state has a strong disestablishment interest, a strong interest in not funding clerical education. So Locke versus Davy is the main precedent here, and if you're new to the area, it's probably the best way to orient yourself around this case, right? What does Locke mean? The government here reads Locke broadly to mean that the government can generally exclude religion from government benefit programs. The government stresses how Locke emphasized the light burden of being denied government funds for something. Church schools can always pay for their own playgrounds if they want. The church here, by contrast, reads Locke narrowly to be a case about the government funding clerical instruction. When the dissent in Locke accuses the majority of authorizing the exclusion of religious institutions from all generally applicable benefit programs, the majority counters by saying that the only governmental interest at stake in the case was in the not funding the training of clergy, and to the church that makes Locke very narrow and puts Locke essentially on their side. So that's the sort of general background. I'm kind of running out of time. There are a bunch of other things that are important in the case that I'm hoping Marty and Tom will get to, or that will come out in discussion. There's an important issue about the Blaine Amendments, for example. There's an argument that these old state constitutional provisions, like Missouri's here, that deny government funding to religious institutions are flatly unconstitutional because they were adopted at the time out of anti-Catholic animus. You know, I don't know if I expect the court to really reach that argument, but it's out there. So we'll see what Tom and Marty think of it. That's more to say, but I've been told that I'm on a tight time schedule. So I'll turn it over to Tom and leave the rest for rebuttal and question and answer.
Okay. Well, Tom? Thank you, Chris. Am I on? Okay.
You are. We can hear you.
Okay, good. Thank you, Chris. And it's great to be here. Talking about this really interesting case with Chris and Marty. So I'm going to speak mostly on behalf of the school. I filed an amicus brief in support of the church in this case, in support of the petitioner, and I'm going to rely on some of the things that I said there. The rule applied by the state of Missouri singles out this daycare for exclusion from a safety-related benefit. As Chris explained, the resurfacing of playgrounds from tires, solely because the school is operated by a church or is sectarian. And there may be a little bit of a difference there. Missouri thus singles out, in effect, the people, including the children, who use that playground. And under the circumstances of this case, there's no showing of any real significant likelihood that this assistance would violate the Establishment Clause. And so, in my view, it's the denial, the exclusion, singling out of the church daycare for exclusion from this benefit violates the Free Exercise Clause. Our system of church-state relations under the two religion clauses sometimes treats religious organizations differently from others, and sometimes it treats them the same, and sometimes that similar treatment is required, sometimes it's simply permitted. Chris went through the background on that quite well. This is a case, the church argues, and I would argue, in which equal treatment is required. So the cases on which the church relies for this argument state a general principle that the government cannot presumptively single out a person or institution for regulation or a disability solely because of its religious status. The first case that they rely on for that is the Church of the Lukumi case from the early 1990s, a Free Exercise Clause case in which the city of Hialeah, Florida, had a set of ordinances that, both in their text and in their structure, singled out a religious group, the Santeria worshipers, for as the really the only group that was permitted to that was prohibited from killing animals, and they were doing it in a ritual sacrifice. The court set forth the principle that you can't single out, that singling out religion for discriminatory regulation like that violates the free exercise clause. Now, that principle doesn't necessarily carry over to all cases that don't involve regulation, but that rather involve the denial of benefits, as in this as is the case here in the Trinity Lutheran case. But Lukumi stands for a proposition that discrimination against religion at least ought to be taken seriously. The other case that the school relies on as its affirmative case is a case from the 1970s called McDaniel versus Patey. Tennessee excluded clergy from serving in the state legislature and therefore in the state constitutional convention to amend the state constitution. It singled out clergy as unable to serve in the legislature. That, the court said, was a violation of the free exercise clause. Now, notice in that case, there's not a sanction imposed. It's not a punishment. It's not a monetary fine. It's not regulation in that sense. It's rather a disability. And that, I think, is the principle that covers this case. We have the singling out of a church-operated school for a disability, and that does raise serious free exercise questions. Now, what I'd like to talk about is how this case is a category in which discrimination against religion is particularly improper. It involves benefits promoting ordinary safety and health, the resurfacing of playgrounds with rubber so that children using them are less likely to be injured. In its application for funds, the church stated that its current pea gravel surface was uneven, presenting a tripping hazard, and was unforgiving if and when a child falls. The issue at hand here is the safety and health of those using the playground, which included children in the daycare and also children in the neighborhood. In our system, religious institutions are not and cannot be singled out for denial of the basic safe and healthy benefit, health benefit, safety and health benefits that are provided to other institutions: police protection, fire protection, water and sewer connections, roads, sidewalks, repair of roads, repair of sidewalks. That principle goes back to and was recognized in the very first of the aid cases under the Establishment Clause that Chris Lund referred to, Everson versus Board of Education. The court at first in that case stated a very strong principle of separation of church and state in the first few paragraphs of the opinion. But then it said, this is a case involving a public benefit of reimbursements for bus travel to and from schools. And that is a matter of the general safety benefits that the state provides, that the modern state provides to all parents, and they cannot be denied to those using religious schools. Now, Everson was an Establishment Clause decision. It held that the state could include parents attending religious schools in that benefit of reimbursement for bus travel. But the language that it used was, I think, telling, in that the court said if the religious school parents were singled out for the denial of this benefit, that would be impinging on their free exercise. That was not a direct holding, but it was the language that the court used. The court said the state would be the adversary of the parents if it did that. It would be handicapping the parents. And Everson came in 1947 at the dawn, really, of the modern welfare state, in which provision for the safety and health of people is not limited to just the old-fashioned police and fire brigade that come and put out the fire at the church. There are extensions of that principle into new kinds of statutes and sometimes into direct grants for the funding of safety improvements. And so bus transportation was an example of that. Children were safer if they were riding buses as opposed to walking to school. And playground resurfacing is an example of that, too. Some other examples of this, both actual programs and hypotheticals. The federal government offers grants to organizations whose buildings particularly need asbestos removal. And the religious schools are eligible to participate in that program, religious daycares. Other religious institutions are eligible to participate in that. The Department of Homeland Security offers grants for security enhancement to buildings that are at special risk of terrorist attacks. Grants have gone to synagogues and mosques under that program. A hypothetical, you can extend the hypothetical. Suppose that to address the problem of lead in the water in Flint, Michigan, the state offered targeted grants to organizations whose pipes in their buildings most needed replacement to prevent lead poisoning. Would we say that a daycare operated by a church or a school operated by a church or even a church itself should be excluded from participating in that program simply because it is a church or is church operated? I think the answer would be that it's something fundamentally wrong about excluding the religious organization from that kind of benefit. The safety of children and other people attending or using those organizations is just as much a concern to society as is anyone else's safety. The court has said in another context, and we cited in our brief, that safety and healthcare, as court has recognized, are the cardinal civic responsibilities of government. A denial of eligibility to receive such benefits raises, I think, real questions about a denial of equal citizenship for persons using the church-operated daycare. And equal citizenship has become a relevant category for the court in recent decisions, including the gay rights cases. And I think it's relevant to the religion clauses as well. The state in this case relies on Locke versus Davey, but this is a very different case, as Chris explained. That was an exclusion of a student training for the ministry. The court said that that was the only interest involved in that case. The student there could still attend a deeply religious college and receive a scholarship. He could take deeply religious courses and still receive a scholarship, and so the court said the burden there was minimal. Here it's a total exclusion of the institution and the people using it. In the last couple minutes, let me talk about the other side of Locke versus Davey. The other thing that the court said in that case was that there was a historic and substantial establishment clause related interest in denying funding for a student preparing for the ministry, which Joshua Davey was doing. Here, though, the establishment clause interests are really much more minimal. There's very little likelihood of a religious use for this money, and that is a key question under the current Establishment Clause jurisprudence. As Chris explained in Mitchell versus Helms, the controlling opinion which was joined by Justice Breyer, is an O'Connor opinion. Breyer joined it, allowed the provision of computers and instructional materials to religious schools on the ground that there were rules against the use of those computers for religious teaching, and any evidence of actual use for religious teaching was de minimis. If the likelihood of using computers in a religious school for religious purposes is de minimis, then surely the threat of religious uses of the money on a children's playground is also de minimis. And the department's guidelines already require that the aid be used for, quote, secular rather than sectarian purposes, Under those circumstances, the church argues, and I think they're right, that there was no need to go further and disqualify the school because it was operated by a church. In any event, if that kind of evidence came out that the playground was used for religious purposes, that might be something to consider in discovery, but it's important to realize that this case was dismissed on the pleadings. I think I'll stop at that point, and there are a few more things that I'd say, but we want to come in within 12 minutes. The denial of eligibility for safety benefits to the students using a religious institution, that's really a core form of discrimination in modern society. There ought to be a very good reason for it, and there's not a good enough reason here.
This is Marty.
That's me.
Yeah, Professor Marty Lederman, go right ahead.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure to be on the podcast, as always, especially with Chris and Tom. And they've really teed up the questions beautifully and the case. And I have almost nothing to add to that description. So I'll start by coming at the case from a little bit different angle. Quite reasonably, looks at this particular program, this Missouri funding of the purchase of excess tires to turn them into school playground surfaces, and says, quite reasonably, what possible reason might the Missouri legislature have for deciding to exclude categorically the four-year-olds at church playgrounds, where the children at all other playgrounds are at least eligible to receive or to be the beneficiaries of this benefit. And it wouldn't have made much sense, I suppose, if the Missouri legislature yesterday or whenever this program began up and decided, you know what, let's exclude the church playgrounds. They would need a pretty good reason for doing that, and I think it's very unlikely any legislature would have done so. But that's not really how this question arises. The question arises because, in fact, Missouri, as Tom pointed out, Missouri has three provisions in its state constitution that, separately and together, provide a principle that the state may never give direct funds to churches. And those three constitutional provisions were enacted, ratified in Missouri's constitution. The first of them when Missouri became a state in 1821, the second in 1870, and the third in 1875, all of which, and they reflect the provisions in 38 other state constitutions. That is to say, 39 states have in their state constitutions absolute categorical bright-line rules, the state shall not give money to churches. And this is a long-standing American principle coming out of the Jefferson's bill that replaced the bill that Tom was talking about in colonial Virginia that would have taxed that would have provided tax dollars to churches. In fact, Virginia passes a bill famously that prohibits the use of money to give to churches, and that becomes the template for these 39 states to prohibit the use of funding to churches. Now, Tom points out that in recent years, some governments, including the federal government, have on fairly rare occasions given grants to churches for various reasons like emergency repairs and the like and protections. But in fact, throughout most of American history, it has been a fairly strong rule of thumb that direct financial aid cannot be given to churches. The same way that churches are singled out for bright-line rules that favor them in certain instances, such as the ministerial exception that the court recognized in the Hosanna-Tabor decision several terms ago, so too there are a few bright-line rules that exclude churches from what might otherwise be benefits that they would be entitled to, not because of hostility toward religion, anything but. That's not what motivated all of these states for all of these years to put these provisions in their constitution, but instead for very basic reasons expressed by Madison and Jefferson at the founding that are somewhat about protecting taxpayer conscience and constitutional reasons for not requiring taxpayers to fund religious institutions, but more importantly for the protection of the institutions themselves and of the relationship between the state and the church. Madison, for instance, argued that when churches become dependent on the state for funding or for resources, it creates an unhallowed perversion of the means of salvation, especially when the state is looking to the church to perform and to secure some sort of civic or civil benefit. Similarly, both the Virginia Bill and most of these state constitutional provisions were put in place for other reasons as well, these bright line rules. One, that usually, not always, and this might be the exceptional case that doesn't prove the rule, but usually direct funding programs involve a lot of discretionary decisions by administrators and other state decision makers or legislators about who should get the money and how much and under what circumstances, under what conditions, and the like. And that kind of decision-making is, as the court put it in one case, pregnant within the involvement of government decision-makers in the church. And so in order to prevent or avoid that kind of involvement, we set up a bright-line rule that religious institutions have to make do on their own. As Doug Laycock described the settlement at the founding, churches either would support themselves or they would not, but the government would neither help nor interfere. The church was expected to go to its own to collect funds and to use them. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, these provisions were motivated by a desire to avoid competition among sects or discriminations among churches for scarce government resources, because of the thought that that kind of competition among churches and religious institutions is very dangerous and something we want to avoid. It would, in Madison's words, destroy the moderation and harmony which the forbearance of our laws to intermeddle with religion has produced amongst its several sects. And in explaining the Missouri constitutional provisions, the Missouri Supreme Court said something similar to this. It said, we have these bright line rules because we don't want the centers of local political battles to be dangerous to the peace of society, where there must be equal religious rights to all and special religious privileges to none. The faithful observance of our constitutional provisions happily makes such a condition impossible. So these quite benign, in fact, quite religion-protective reasons were the motivations for these 39 states to provide these sorts of rules, these bright-line rules. Now, like any bright-line rules, it's not hard to imagine cases, we usually do it in law school exams, but here we have it in a Supreme Court case, where most of the rationales for the rule don't seem to be implicated, or at least not acutely implicated, by a particular program, such as the one we have here. There probably wouldn't be the sort of intense involvement of the state in the program that Madison was worried about. It's such a small amount of money that it's unlikely to result in an unhallowed perversion of the means of salvation by the church. The church is unlikely to become dependent on Missouri's money, and those sorts of things. And it might even be very unlikely that you'd have religious battles for money. But like all bright-line rules, they're there for a reason. We don't want to have to parse and pick and choose, just like in Hosanna Tabor, which particular cases, which particular funding streams ought or ought not to be the subject of direct funding of churches. And so the principal point I want to make is just one of historical context, which is that what the church here is asking the Supreme Court to do is to breach a fairly bright line rule that has governed American law since the founding, that the state does not give direct monetary aid to churches. And now that's in and of itself, the fact that something's been a practice for a long time, and that even that it's in a lot of state constitutions, surely does not make it constitutional. We know that. We can look at the gay marriage case, for instance. It doesn't immunize it from constitutional challenge. But it sure makes one think, stop and pause and think, that perhaps this is not just a hostile exclusion of religion, as in the Lukumi case, the Santeria case that Tom and Chris described, but is instead something quite different, a phenomenon that's quite different, quite long-lasting, and that was done for very good constitutional reasons. Now, to get a little bit doctrinal, let me break this up quickly into three areas, starting with the Establishment Clause. Now, both Chris and Tom assumed that Missouri could give this money to the churches if it weren't for these constitutional provisions in the state constitution. But I don't think that's at all clear. I think, actually, the better reading of the governing cases would be that this would be unconstitutional under the Establishment Clause. Now, whether there are five votes currently on the court or on next year's court to sustain that view, I don't know. But for instance, just to give, just to invoke the case that that Tom started with, Rosenberger. In Rosenberger, Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion, a 5-4 opinion, and Justice Kennedy said in that opinion, he was went out of his way in a couple of places to say this is constitutional because it does not involve direct money grants to religious institutions. He said, quote, "It is, of course, true that if the state pays a church's bills, it is subsidizing it, and we must guard against this abuse." That's a pretty strong statement, right? Guarding against the abuse. And he went out of his way to say that here, the dissent, he said, takes insufficient cognizance of the undisputed fact that no public funds flowed directly to the religious institutions' coffers. Well, here they would. So even under Rosenberger, or at least Justice Kennedy's opinion, this would seem to violate the Establishment Clause, as it would under Justice O'Connor's governing opinion in Mitchell versus Helms. Now, those are 15- and 20-year-old cases, and we don't know how they would turn out. But I think it's worth pausing at least to say, wow, this would be, you know, a reversal of an assumption in the court's Establishment Clause jurisprudence that prevailed for a very long time. I don't think the court ought to answer the Establishment Clause question one way or the other, because I think it's sufficient to simply hold that Missouri can, like at least 39 states do, have a bright-line rule forbidding the direct payment of funds to churches. Now, Missouri has raised both a free exercise and an equal protection objection to this bright line. The church has raised a free exercise and equal protection objections to this bright line rule that I think would very much call into question the constitutional provisions that have been in place in these 39 states for well over a century, some going back to the founding. The free exercise claim, I think, is not terribly strong, because I don't think this, at least in the context of this particular program, because I don't think anyone would argue that the church is in any way coerced or pressured, let alone required, to change its religious precepts by the fact that it would be categorically excluded from this funding stream for the playground, for the tire purchase to create new playgrounds in its daycare center. The denial of that grant is only given, as Chris said, to 14 recipients a year. The vast majority of playgrounds in Missouri don't get it. The fact that you don't get it isn't going to have the slightest effect on the church's religious obligations or practices or precepts or the church's religious character or anything of the sort. It's simply not going to affect the exercise of the religion of the church. And so then we get to the free exercise clause, to the equal protection clause, which I think is a more interesting sort of claim. And Locke versus Davy, the case that Chris talked about, dealt with both the free exercise claim and the equal protection clause and rejected both claims. And I should say there on the free exercise front, there the pressure on Joshua Davy to actually change his religious practices to not study for the divinity was much, much stronger than any pressure on the church here to abandon its religious practices. So the free exercise claim here is even weaker than in Locke. And the equal protection clause claim is too. I think, you know, yes, Locke can be distinguished by saying that was about the use of the money for training clergy. But that longstanding state law principle that money shouldn't be given to train clergy, the court was right to say that that was well established, but it's not nearly as well established as the basic rule that states should not give direct money aid to churches, something that's even more, on which there's even a greater and longer standing and more well established consensus than the rule against funding for training clergy. So Locke, in that sense, is a stronger case, I think, for the state, and in another sense as well, namely that Locke involved, as Tom pointed out, an indirect funding program, one that was clearly constitutional under the Establishment Clause, or would have been, had Washington State agreed to give the money to Joshua Davey to study divinity. It could have done so under the Establishment Clause and the Zelman voucher decision. Whereas here, Missouri isn't denying vouchers. You know, it's not denying aid to an individual, a religious individual, that it gives to everyone else or makes available to everyone else. Instead, it's denying aid that's available to almost no one else, to a religious institution, direct aid that would be decided by the state rather than by what the court in Zelman called genuine and independent private choice. These would be state decision makers making the decision to fund the church. So in those two respects, I think this is an easier case than Locke versus Davey. It's also different from the McDaniel versus Patey case that my colleagues raised, mostly, I think, because in McDaniel there really was, first of all, there weren't very good reasons for excluding ministers from the state legislature. The reasons all seemed to be very dubious or questionable. But secondly, that exclusion did actually place, of course, a great burden on the minister's exercise of religion, putting him to a choice between the exercise of two very fundamental constitutional rights, rather than just the denial of a minor grant here that won't have much of an effect. So for those reasons, I do think the case is very interesting, perhaps very close, and I think very difficult to predict what the court's going to do. But I think that the state, when this is viewed in the context of 200 years of bright-line rules, both at the federal Establishment Clause level, but more importantly, in about three-quarters of the state constitutions, prohibiting direct funding of churches, I think it would be at least quite dramatic thing for the court to say that those state constitutional provisions are all of a sudden unconstitutional when they've been in place and for religious liberty reasons and religious institutional autonomy reasons since the dawn of the Republic. We were supposed to close up here in about 5 minutes to open it up for Q&A, so I'll stop here and we can go to rebuttal.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. This is Dean Reuter. Before we go to rebuttal, and I do want to go to rebuttal, let me open the floor to questions so people can begin lining up to the extent they have questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We'll take the questions in the order they're received. Before we go to rebuttal, one more piece of business. Our upcoming schedule tomorrow at 1 p.m. Eastern Time at the same number, we'll be speaking with Wall Street Journal contributor and author Kimberly Strassel about her new book, The Intimidation Game. Thursday, our call will concern litigation and new rules on discovery. And Friday, we'll be talking about China and The Hague. So check the website and monitor your emails for upcoming calls. Today, of course, we're talking about Trinity Lutheran. I want to give each of our guests a very brief response. We've gone a little bit long in our opening remarks, but literally just 60 seconds to respond and augment, if you would. And one thing I'm curious about is whether or not we have a factual disagreement, even if we do, does it matter? And that's the intent behind the Blaine Amendments that you've been discussing, and Professor Lederman's characterized them as benign or even securing intentionally religious liberties. I've heard them described otherwise in other forums, but maybe that can be part of the discussion. With that, Professor Lund, you want to take a minute?
Sure. There's so many things to say here. I think one tricky thing about this area is that we're dealing with a different problem than they dealt with in the 18th or the 19th century, right? The issue that the drafters of the state constitutional provisions or the Establishment Clause were concerned about was the preferential funding of one particular church or maybe a group of churches that's the Memorial and Remonstrance, right? This is the funding of religious institutions as a small part of an overall overall funding program, the religious institutions in Trinity Lutheran, you know, they're going to receive a small part of the government's money no matter what. And then on the Establishment Clause point, you know, I see the Establishment Clause issue a little differently than Marty. You know, I agree that under the controlling concurrence in Mitchell versus Helms, the question is diverse, whether the government's aid has been diverted to religious use. And in this case, we're about grants for schools to construct playgrounds, and I think the diversion issue would be whether the playgrounds are used for worship. But the money isn't used here to construct playgrounds. It's to resurface the playgrounds with recycled tires. So I think the diversion issue technically becomes whether the, not whether the playgrounds are used for religious purposes, but whether the tires are used for religious purposes. That's obviously pretty hard to imagine. I think the harder part for the church here is jumping the tracks from moving. You know, I think it's pretty clear that the funding, the church here would be constitutional, but to say that funding is constitutionally required, I think that's the hard part. All right, I'm done. Hello?
All right, very good. Professor Berg, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, let me just say a couple of things. Marty talked about bright line rules, and I guess the first thing I'd say about that is that bright line rules are more defensible when they don't have as serious an effect on rights as they might. And what's happened, I would say, in the modern state is that bright line rules against ever including a church in a grant program have much more effect now than they used to. The welfare state means that we don't provide safety and health benefits, including important ones. We don't provide them anymore only through the general provision of police and fire protection, which, notice, of course, everyone takes that for granted, and obviously Marty's not challenging that, and no one is challenging that. But in the modern state, we are concerned about safety and health in many other ways, and we use many other mechanisms to get at that and to protect people. Our concern for the safety and health of citizens is broader, and so the welfare state has, I think, changed the frame of reference in which we talk about excluding churches. It's important, I think, to remember that this is a case where the ground for eligibility is not the church being a church. The ground for eligibility is that it operates a school, in this case a daycare or a preschool, and it happens to be operated by a church. So really the question that we're talking about here is whether a school that is subject to regulations by the state and can also share in the benefits of that of state action when it's when it's operated by a church. The same Virginia that passed a rule against any aid to churches also prevented churches from incorporating. And that rule in the modern state, we say, is we wouldn't allow that. Churches have the right to incorporate, like other institutions. Some of the old rules about no aid to churches are a reflection of earlier understandings of what was government aid and what was government involvement versus a baseline of safety and health benefits that all citizens are entitled to. Very briefly, let me say that the case law that Marty relies on from the Establishment Clause and that the state relies on, that's a line of cases of which four decisions have already been overruled and others cast into significant doubt by what the court has said so far. So that line of case law is hard to stand on that firmly. As far as the Free Exercise Clause claim. Marty says there's no pressure on the church or anyone to change their precepts, and therefore there's no free exercise clause violation. I think the free exercise clause has broader implications than that. I think if the state of Missouri decided to impose a slight extra surcharge on the Trinity Lutheran daycare, so suppose they charged it, $15 more a year, another 2% or something to operate, because it was a church-operated daycare, that really wouldn't have much pressure, put much pressure on the church to change its precepts, but it would be a disability and a statement about the unequal status of religious institutions that I think wouldn't be defensible. Similarly, when the clergy were excluded from the legislature in the McDaniel case, I don't think it was any showing that that would pressure them to stop being clergy because they wouldn't be able to serve in the legislature. It was rather a matter of what citizens are entitled to in the modern state. And I think that citizens that attend religious institutions are entitled to equal treatment in the provision of benefits designed to ensure their safety.
Professor,
okay, I'll try to be very fast so we can get to questions. Three quick points.
You.
First, to start with Tom's very good point that these bright line rules, although they might have made sense in the 18th and 19th centuries, are under some pressure when in a welfare state context in which all institutions and people become much more dependent upon state largesse and state benefits. That's true, and it would be an interesting case, I think, if this were a case involving some sort of a generally applicable universal entitlement, something that everyone was dependent upon and reliant upon, or like police and fire, but it's anything but, right? It's the sort of benefit that almost no one in the state gets, and that doesn't really implicate that concern, but it is a very well-taken point. Secondly, the Establishment Clause cases on which I was relying haven't been overruled at all. It's Justice O'Connor's governing opinion in Mitchell versus Helms and Justice Kennedy's majority opinion in Rosenberger that expressed this view that direct funding implicates the Establishment Clause, and not because of diversion, as Chris suggested. Justice O'Connor went out of her way to say, even apart from diversion, the direct funding of money to churches raises its own independent and more fundamental Establishment Clause problems that need to be avoided. Finally, to address Dean's question at the outset about the Blaine, this isn't a Blaine amendment, right? So these three amendments, the first two precede the Blaine era, and they are about direct. This is not one of those that's preventing funding of schools, private schools, most of which at the time were Catholic. These were absolute bars on the funding of churches, the vast majority of which were not Catholic, that preceded the Blaine Amendment. So the Blaine Amendment is just a simple red herring in this case. I'm done.
Thank you, gentlemen. We do have one question pending. If you have a question in the audience, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. But for now, let's take our first call of the day.
I guess I actually have two related questions. The first is that the ACLU has said that this is not permissible unless the state puts adequate safeguards to make sure that these rubberized pellets are not used for religious purposes. And exactly how do you use rubberized pellets for religious purposes, and what kind of adequate safeguards would there be? And then the second question involves the question of strict scrutiny. Why isn't this just a standard equal protection case? You have the state making a classification based upon religiosity, saying we're going to exclude anybody who's religious from receiving this public benefit. Why shouldn't that be subject to being narrowly tailored to satisfy a compelling governmental interest instead of having an entirely different test because it involves a grant of funds to a religious institution? Those are my two questions.
Terrific. We've got just 5 minutes left, so let me give anybody a shot at that question. Who wants to go first?
I'll take the first part. Go ahead, guys. Oh, sure. I mean, I think what the ACLU was saying about the safeguards is, in a lot of these cases in the 70s and 80s, there were safeguards on the use of the money, that there were statutory restrictions in how the church would use the money to make sure that they would use it the way the government intended, and that it wouldn't be diverted to any kind of religious use, and that maybe the government might be able to claw back the money if they don't follow the restrictions. I imagine that's what the ACLU wants here. Again, I don't see the risk of diversion at all here, because this just isn't the kind of thing that could be diverted to religious use. right? You know, this is just recycled tires. It's hard for me to see how they'd be used in worship or how they, you know, augment or facilitate worship. So I guess I kind of agree with the question, but that is what the issue is worried about.
On that first question, I would agree. I think there's very little likelihood of diversion. I think you could maybe make a prohibition that the playground can't be used for worship or religious education. Probably won't be anyway. It wouldn't be much of a problem. And also to ensure the record's a little unclear that this money is not being diverted. This is not saving the church money that it would otherwise use on religious activities, which seems to be the case, but is a little bit unclear. But on the second question, the reason the Equal Protection Clause, the court really hasn't decided that religion, and in particular, this is not about individuals' religion. This isn't like McDaniel versus Pateau. This is about religious institutions and churches in particular. Whether treating churches differently triggers strict scrutiny under the Equal Protection Clause is nothing the court has ever suggested. And in fact, as I suggested at the start, churches are often singled out both for beneficial and, in this case, disfavored, in some sense, treatment, and have been throughout American history without anyone suggesting that it raises strict scrutiny. That doesn't mean it shouldn't be interrogated, maybe quite carefully, to make sure that there's not impermissible or pretextual motives going on, but I don't think that's the case here.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, sure. Professor Berg, did you want to get in here?
Well, I agree with Marty about you can't have a rule that says religion is everywhere and always a suspect classification. The two religion clauses suggest that religion should be treated differently in some cases, and including churches. But there ought to be a good reason when people attending religious institutions are disqualified from the safety benefits that others get, and there's not a good reason here.
Let me make a final call for questions. We do have a couple minutes left. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. It looks like we have had our final question of the day, gentlemen. Let me give you each...
We should have had a case about free exercise and gay rights or contraception or something. Huh?
Well, we've got quite a few people on the call, but let me give you each... let's go in reverse order than we went for opening remarks. Really just 30 seconds, if you could, with a final thought. Professor Leder,
I think we've covered it pretty much. I would just say it's likely that this will be argued in the November sitting.
Professor Berg?
I just repeat myself. There ought to be a good reason when students attending a religious day school are excluded from safety benefits, and there's not a good reason here, not a strong reason.
And a final thought from Professor Lund.
Thanks for having me on the panel. I enjoyed it very much.
That's the perfect final thought. With that, let me thank you all for joining us. We certainly appreciate your time and your comments here. To the audience, thank you as well, and thank you for your questions. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is tomorrow at this same number at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll be talking with Kimberly Strassel about her new book, The Intimidation Game. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.